Hey, let's turn our Bibles to the book of Esther. So, Gospel for Asia, many of you are familiar with the Gospel for Asia. Their representatives have been here more than once and just sharing with the great opportunity to share the love of God and the gospel in India, Nepal, and Bangladesh. So, an opportunity this Christmas to, I believe you can get a catalog on the way out and buy a water buffalo, I guess, for Christmas or some sort of gift. It really goes a long way for people that are with less income and greater needs maybe than we have. So, Book of Esther. Just a reminder tonight, the week of fasting and prayer is going throughout this week. You know, we come to a book, it starts with a lot of feasting, and as you read through it, there's also fasting. And the feasting, you know, some of the things that go on when there's feasting aren't always the best things, but when God's people, in their times of need, we'll see them fast as we study through this book and crying out to God, and the amazing way God works. Times where, as in the book of Esther, things seem almost hopeless, yet God works in an incredible way to deliver the people of God. And so we get an opportunity for 5 days to seek the Lord in prayer and fasting and joining with churches tonight, each night this week through Thursday night. And I think it's a great opportunity. It's a great time. You know, we look at our building situation. We have a lease that we've had now it'll be 10 years. And for various reasons, got into a situation, didn't renew our lease, and then began to negotiate to purchase the property and for whatever various reasons, just couldn't come to an agreed price with the landlord. Our lease ends December 31st, and that isn't necessarily something to be over-alarmed with, but it could be. I don't know. I guess we'll have to see, but we have certainly a situation with the building to continue to seek God about, and I'm fully confident God is going to deliver us. I believe He's made it clear, but yet the need to seek the Lord. And then just in our lives, I look in the needs in the church, and boy, there's such great need in people's lives and hurting families, struggling people, the great need to seek the Lord in prayer and in fasting. And, you know, even radio, for instance, a great opportunity we have. What a privilege to bring the gospel to people through the airwaves, something that we've been interested with, and all the needs there. I mean, I can just keep going. So I hope you're able to set apart time. Fasting is a personal thing. You do it as you feel led. That's between you and the Lord. And I won't judge you if I see you at McDonald's, and I won't judge you, you know, if you're sitting there with a steak or whatever. That's up to you and the Lord, what that means to you, how you're going to fast and seek God. But to do it congregationally and to do it with thousands of believers, it's always a privilege. I find God speak to me during these seasons. I find Him minister to me. I find Him prepare me. I think it's part of the life of the church. A church that prays is a church that's healthy. So I hope you're considering how you might just see God this week, maybe as a family, maybe as an individual, of course, congregationally too. So each night this week, with the video, we get to webcast, and being part of that, we can gather with churches. Or if you can't get here, you can join in on the web too and watch live. So anyhow, the book of Esther. We go from feasting to fasting. As we start a fast, it's a little difficult to be reading about feasting, so we won't go too much with the feasting in our text. But great study. Let's say a word of prayer, and we'll begin here in Esther chapter 1. Father, as we look through the Bible week by week and now come to this next book, next passage, and we consider history, we consider incredible time with your people, the nation of Israel, and just the way you worked. We look at the challenges. We look at the way you work providentially, sovereignly, the way you work in people's lives. In some instances, the things that you do through them, they would never, ever have guessed. Would just be amazed, blown away by what you did. And here we are, Lord, as your people, and gathered this Sunday morning. We ask, as we begin this study through this book, you take these words and make them alive to our hearts and increase our faith. We think of that verse, you know, in Ezekiel, where you look for hearts that are loyal to you. Your eyes look to and fro for an instrument, a person that would be loyal to you, that is loyal to you, that you could use in ways that you can touch a lot of lives. And Lord, we want to be those people. So minister to us, Lord, as we study your word. Minister to us this week as we seek you in prayer and as we fast. Bless this congregation, God. I thank you for your grace and favor upon us, and ask that even now your Holy Spirit would be upon all of us, even myself, as we go through this text. In Jesus' name, amen. Hey, before we dig in, as we start a book, we always want to do a little bit of the background, right, and prepare the scene for where we're going. But this book, we studied Nehemiah, we studied Ezra, so this book goes back in time a little bit from where we just were. We were in the book of Nehemiah, and if you look at the historical timeline, Esther moves back a little bit, not too far, about 30, 40 years. And it actually takes place during, timeline-wise, it takes place during the book of Ezra. In fact, you can take the book of Esther and stick it right between chapter 6 and chapter 7 of Ezra. Remember the beginning of Ezra, God allows through Cyrus, the Jews, and about 60,000 to go back to Jerusalem after their exile. And during that time, there's some battle, but eventually they rebuild their temple. And it's after that time, and it's before Ezra himself comes later, about 80 years later, with another wave of exiles. It's after the building of the temple and before Ezra comes, is that Esther now, we have this book, this story of this this orphan girl, really, who is adopted by an uncle and becomes the queen, married to the Persian king. I'm always amazed by just the history with the nation of Israel, even today's history. But the history here, it's incredible how God has disciplined the nation, brought them into exile, and then how he takes Jews and puts them in significant places in the Persian government and in the Babylonian government. And now he takes a girl, an orphan girl, an orphan, and makes her queen. It's incredible what God does to protect his people and to work in the lives of his people. So what God will do and is doing in your life and in my life, it's wonderful to watch. I think life sometimes is like a movie, man. It's a video we watch. I can't believe the things that God does at times. So the author of this book, who compiled it, we don't necessarily know for sure who it is. We're not told. Mordecai is a principal character in the book, and many believe that he's the guy that's compiled this. What's interesting is the name of God never appears in the book. It's the only book in the Bible where you don't have the name of God. And in some ways, it reads almost like a secular book. Certainly, it's about the Jews, and it's about specific Jews and how God defended the nation too. But it has sort of, maybe it was written for the Persian government and an official document. But it never has the name of God. Certainly, though, God is in the book. He's all through the book. And he's working powerfully in the lives of his people. When is it written? We'll leave it up to the experts. But the king that's reigning at this time is Ahasuerus, or Xerxes is a secular name, the Greek name of this king. And because it's written in the past tense, you read it as a narrative, so you're going along with a story, but some of the statements, clearly whoever compiled it after the events, obviously the entire events, and it seems to be even after the entire reign of this king. Although, some date it, I was doing some study on that, and some date it as far later as the 2nd century B.C., although it seems it doesn't have any Greek words. Later, the Greek culture really impacts even the Jews, and so a lot of the Greek language, we have even the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, and if this document was written a long time later, you think it has some Greek words in it, but it doesn't. It has Persian words, Hebrew words. It seems to be written probably, I think, I'll leave it up to the experts, not too long after the reign of Ahasuerus. But, and you're wondering why that's important. I don't know, but I figured I'd tell you anyway. So there you go. But what's the theme? Again, it's the sovereignty of God and the providential working of God, that God is in charge of all matter, all the time, all the universe, and he's working his wonderful story to his glory and the redemption of man, you and I, and the way he can work through nations and kings and history. It's just tremendous how he works. And it's a reminder of that as we go through. You have this scripture, Psalm chapter 22, verse 28. For the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. We're reminded of that here. In Daniel chapter 4, verse 35, all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He, that is God, does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, what have you done? But God is going to do what he's going to do. And thank God he's loving, and thank God for the promises we have towards us. Romans chapter 8, verse 28. And we know that all things work together for good. To those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. You see in the book of Esther, as you do in the story of Joseph and many other instances, where bad events, what seems to be bad events, in some instances horrifying events, God does as he promises to his people. He works them to good and to his glory. And you might be in a situation, you might be in a season where you feel you've experienced a lot of bad, you know, and a lot of hard times, and a lot of hurtful things, but God promises, God works sovereignly and powerfully to work things to his good, to our good and to his glory. So, there is the question, why is the book of Esther in the Bible? Well, obviously, it's about the Jews, and it has this powerful history, but because it doesn't necessarily deal with spiritual truths as much, you know, doctrine, or it doesn't even mention the name of God, but yet it's that key history, and it's a reminder of how God is working on behalf of his people, how the nation of Israel, God has a plan and purpose, and nobody's going to stop it. And even today, God has a plan with the nation of Israel, and he's not done. And the book of Esther is one of those reminders. You have the Feast of Purim, so we learn about that here in this book, and it commemorates this deliverance of the nation of Israel. But there's other feasts, you know, the Feast of Passover that commemorates the deliverance of the nation of Israel out of Egypt. And then you have Hanukkah, you know, that's going to be celebrated here shortly with the Jews celebrating just the deliverance during the Maccabean period. And God has a plan. He has promises he's made to Abraham, and we see him in his faithful way, being faithful to his promises. So we also have beautiful people we get to study, children of God, like Mordecai, and of course Esther. It's just this godly woman, this beautiful woman in so many ways. And we get to be reminded of just how God uses people and just get to see their character and their beauty. So chapter 1, verse 1. We got that out of the way. Let's go. Verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. This was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the citadel, that in the third year of his reign he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. And when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days, for all the people who were present in Shushan the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen, and purple and silver rods and marble pillars, and the couches were of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble. And they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance according to the generosity of the king. In accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory, for so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. So we study this powerful king. That's the way you come into the book. A very powerful king. Few people in history have had the power that this man has, the wealth that this man has, and we're introduced to him. His name, again, is Ahasuerus. That is the Hebrew derivative of his Persian name, which is similar to that. It is translated again later when the Greek language became more prevalent. Xerxes the First is what we refer to him secularly. He reigned from 486 B.C. to 465 B.C., succeeding his father Darius the Great, who was a tremendous ruler. And it states there he reigned over 127 provinces. When it says India, it's referring to the Indus River, which is on the western side of India, the area of Pakistan. His father extended the empire that way to get some gold, and so now he's taken over after, it's his third year, so after the death of his father. And the empire goes all the way from where, you know, Persia, Iran, all the way to just about India. And then it says Ethiopia. Ethiopia would be today, geographically, Ethiopia at this ancient time was the area of Sudan, geographically, just south of Egypt. But you've got these provinces and these satraps. Satraps were like the counties or the countries within the kingdom. And there was 31 of those. And then these provinces. But you've got a magnificent empire. This is before planes and TV and cell phones and internet and automobiles. This is a huge territory for a man to reign over. Shushan, we were introduced to that back in the story of Nehemiah. This is the governmental palace of the Empire of Persia. It started with his dad. His dad, Darius the Great, built a tremendous palace structure and fortress there. And that's where Nehemiah was. And Nehemiah, a little bit, about 40 years later, starts at this very palace area of Shushan where he was the cupbearer. It's about 150 miles north of the Persian Gulf. And is the governing center. That's why it says there, he sat on the throne of his kingdom there. So we find ourselves in the third year of his reign. So it's 483 BC, and you just can't help but consider just the picture of his wealth. It's incredible. And there is this sense, and I think there's multiple layers here, but that he's boasting, he's showing the world, he's showing his people his great wealth. So you note his boasting. He does this demonstration of his wealth to others through what is here is three feasts. There's a feast that he gives to his military officials and to his governing officials from his entire empire. And we're told the feast goes 180 days, so 6 months. Can you imagine that? Here we are starting a fast, and this guy's got a feasting going on for 180 days. Can you imagine a six-month party? My goodness, that'll get you in trouble. But now, it's not that all his officers and officials were there for 180 days, but the feast went on for 180 days, and it's very probable that they came in, you know, from different areas at different times. All these different leaders, this is a huge empire, they would come in, and it's this ongoing feast for 180 days. There's then the last to commemorate that, a seven-day mighty feast where all of Shushan now is celebrating, and the men in with him, and then the women with Queen Vashti. There are beautiful elements in this fasting and feasting that goes on. We see there, not fasting, but this feasting, we see there's the white and blue, the Persian colors, there's the gold and silver, there's gold couches, silver couches, the pavement is not, you know, ceramic tile, it's alabaster, it's turquoise, it's marble. And evidently, you know, Alexander the Great conquered Shushan a long time later, over a century later, maybe 2 centuries later, a century and a half. And but as they began to really archaeologically dig in this area, they began to find even some of the evidence of the tremendous, just the beauty of Shushan in the time of the Persians. And so you see, you know, of this palace, you see the tremendous wealth. Now, there's something else probably going on here that we don't get in our Bible. And it isn't just boasting where he's trying to just show his wealth. It's very probable if when we tie the story of Esther into the secular history we know of this king, is that this man is preparing for war. That's what he's doing. And he's preparing for a mighty war. We know that his father sought to invade Greece and had a little bit of a success, but then was tremendously defeated at the area of Marathon. And then later wanted to invade Greece again, but died before that. And now his son, Ahasuerus, takes over, and stated historically by the Greek historian Herodotus. Herodotus tells us that this boy, this king now, wanted to vindicate his dad and wanted to subdue Greece. In fact, it is stated by the historian who lived in this time, the Greek historian who lived in this very time, that this king wanted to subdue the entire area of Europe and the world and make it one empire. So, 3 years after this time, a major invasion he prepares for, and he takes a military, and he invades Greece. And the historian tells us, the Greek historian, and some people say this just can't be true, but the naval forces and land forces that he put together, according to Herodias, is 2,600,000 soldiers. Now, even today, that's true. That's what the Greek historian tells us. 2,600,000 soldiers he uses to invade Greece. And now he's down in Iran, so you got to go through Turkey. The problem going from Turkey to Europe is you've got the Black Sea, you've got the Sea of Marmara, you've got the Aegean Sea, and there's this strait. This strait's about 40 miles long, where the Europe and Asia are not only a couple kilometers apart and separated, you know, by water by just a couple kilometers, and it's in the Strait of Hellespont is the ancient name of the strait. Well, anyhow, this man prepares for 3 years, and when his army comes to that strait, he actually builds a bridge out of boats, just puts boats together that are over a kilometer in length, this bridge, and his army passes over the strait, and they invade Europe. They invade Greece. And initially, 480 BC, 3 years later, he's pretty successful, goes through the north, goes into the eastern part of Greece. But then while he's seated on his throne watching the battle, his navy is wiped out by the Greek warships in the area of Salamis. And then later, the year later, his army is defeated. And this is why I tell you all this, because it fits the book of Esther well, is the Greek historian Herodias tells us that after his defeat, he then went to seek solace with his harem. And so chapter 2 is 4 years after chapter 1. And chapter 2 is after, on the calendar, perfectly fit, after this man's great defeat in Greece, where the Greek historian tells us he went to seek solace in his harem. What's chapter 2 all about? His harem. It fits the secular record very well, the book of Esther. And so all that to say, some of you are looking at me baffled. Maybe you need to get the tape and listen through it again, but I won't repeat it. But I believe what's especially going on here is this man's preparing for war. And he wants to take over the world, and he wants to conquer Europe and Greece. And so he has his military officials, he has his governing officials, they're strategizing, he's selling them the idea, and he prepares a force, a military that maybe is as high as 2.6 million soldiers in this time period, and then 3 years later invades Europe, invades Greece. And so all the wealth, all the power, all the beauty, that's where this book starts. And when you have a secular king with a lot of wealth and trying to show himself off and maybe solicits and supports from his officials, you're not surprised to read of all the alcohol too in verse 7. He has royal wine given in abundance according to the generosity of a king. And of course, that's a lot of generosity when you speak of the generosity of a great emperor. And so there's all this alcohol. And so you have the three feasts. The last feast that's noted is with the queen. The queen actually has a feast for the women in the royal palace. And boy, here we got a ladies' tea on Saturday. And maybe you could even argue a biblical reference for ladies' tea right here, man. If you ever go to ladies' tea, us guys never get to. But I've seen them set up. It looks like a royal feast. I can't believe it. You come and check it out, man. I don't know where they get that china from. But it's pretty impressive Saturday. Good study to be in here, the book of Esther for the ladies' tea. I don't know what my wife's going to teach on. But anyhow, so verse 10. There's the powerful king as well, his boasting. We notice alcohol, and that leads us then into the following passage. Verse 10. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehaman, Biztha, Harbana, Bigtha, Abigtha, Zethar, and Carcass, seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, brought by his eunuchs. Therefore, the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for this was the king's manner towards all who knew law and justice. Those closest to him being Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Merez, Marsena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who had access to the king's presence and who ranked highest in the kingdom. What shall we do to Queen Vashti according to the law? Because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus brought to her by the eunuchs. And Menuhin answered before the king and the princes. Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes when they report King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in before him, but she did not come. This very day the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they have heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus there will be excessive contempt and wrath. If it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. When the king's decree, which he will make, is proclaimed throughout all his empire, for it is great, all wives will honor their husbands, both great and small. And the reply pleased the king and the princes, and the king did according to the word of Memucan. Then he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province in its own script, and to every people in their own language, that each man should be master in his own house and speak in the language of his own people. Well, you got a lot of alcohol. You got a lot of partying going on. What you have then is confusion, right? And we got a time of confusion that comes with alcohol. You got foolishness. You got drunkenness. You know, you got a powerful king, and now you got a drunk king, and you got drunk people, you drunk men. And whenever you got that, you usually got confusion that goes on. Too bad this powerful king, all that he had, too bad he didn't take some counsel from the scriptures, right? Didn't take some lessons from the Old Testament. I'm sure he's got access to it. He's got the whole world under his grip, basically. Passages like Proverbs chapter 20, verse 1. Wine is a mocker, strong drink is a brawler, and whoever is led astray by it is not wise. And then you got Proverbs 23, verse 29 to verse 35. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? Who has complaints? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? Those who linger long at the wine. Those who go in search of mixed wine. Do not look at the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it swirls around smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things, and your heart will utter perverse things. Yes, you'll be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, or one who lies at the top of the mast, saying, "They have struck me, but I was not hurt. They have beaten me, but I did not feel it. When shall I awake that I may see another drink?" You know, all the exhortations in the Old Testament, they keep carded with that red stuff, man, the wine. And they don't. And what happens is just confusion. In fact, too bad he didn't take note of the Old Testament, especially Proverbs. You know, that Proverbs would have been available at this time. In Proverbs chapter 31, verse 4, there is even an exhortation to kings about wine. Proverbs 31, verse 4. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the justice of all the afflicted. Those would have been good lessons. You know, even just a little time before this, Daniel was in Shushan, potentially for even a season, or at least by vision he was. And you know, Daniel, the book of Daniel, you have that whole story of Belshazzar, where a Babylonian king has a feast and has 1,000 princes with him and officials and lords. And they party hardy and get drunk, and boy, does he ever get rebuked as he mocks God and says foolish things. And so here's a man with all sorts of power, but a man who's not being wise at this time with the abundance of alcohol. And he, as it says in this verse, he has a little bit too much. He's merry with wine and does something that causes confusion. I just note that today as we just take the text simply. Maybe you're here today and God wants to remind you of that. Don't let that wine, don't let that red stuff, man, entice you any longer, because it has a pretty brutal sting. And don't let the wine or the drugs or whatever that stuff might be that in that sort of category entice you, because what it does is it ruins you, man. It destroys you and it hurts you, and it just creates confusion, it creates a mess, and creates heartache. People get hurt, That's what you get when you got drugs and alcohol. And if you're somebody that's caught up into that and you need prayer today, man, let's pray for you after the service. And anoint you with oil and ask for God's power and grace in your life. But this is just another reminder. You got alcohol, a lot of it, and you end up with confusion. Well, in his merry foolishness, he commands the queen to be brought out to parade her before these other men. That's usually not a good thing to do. And it says, wearing her royal crown. And the truth is, there are many commentaries, if you read them, will tell you that they believe his intent is to bring her out only in a royal crown. So this is not like the beauty pageant, you know what I mean, where she is wearing at least a bikini. She potentially was going to be brought out nude. And there's many that think that. And there's a Jewish tradition that says the men were arguing at the feast. He's got all these people from around the world, these provinces and ethnic cultures, and they began to argue who, in their drunkenness, who were the most beautiful women. So Ahasuerus in his drunkenness says, I'll show you my gal. She tops them all. We got the best ones right here. And calls for her to be brought out. Well, confusion results because Queen Vashti refuses to come out. And you're talking not just like a president, you're talking the emperor of the Persian Empire who's called you to do something. She refuses to do it. Now, why does she refuse? We're not told. Is it modesty? She's like, I don't want to come out like that in front of them. Is that what it is? It's certainly possible. No doubt, it's possible. There's an issue of modesty. And that doesn't want to be, you know, this is going to be very undignifying to stand before these drunken men, and she just doesn't want to do it. It's certainly possible. There is a really strange Jewish tradition, and it's probably not true. I'll just note it to you, that says her refusal had nothing to do with modesty. In fact, the story, the Jewish tradition says that she was willing to come out even completely unclothed, but just before she went out, God smote her with leprosy, so she changed her mind. Now, that's a Jewish tradition, and it's probably not true. There's another interesting one, though, and I'll note it, because it is certainly possible, and that is that she's pregnant. Now, the name Queen Vashti, you can't find outside the Bible, in secular documents, a queen married to Ahasuerus named Vashti. Neither can you find secular reference to Esther. And that doesn't bother us because there's a lot of information in this book that backs itself up to prove that it's historically accurate. But now Vashti, what happens at times is we see, even with Mordecai, that sometimes there's the Hebrew derivative of the name and then there's the Persian derivative of the name. And that might be how some will actually take you down that road and you can study it, where maybe Vashti is a derivative of what we read in secular accounts to be the wife of the king, and that is this woman whose name Armistice. And we read Armistice was the queen to Ahasuerus, and from that union came Artaxerxes, the son Artaxerxes, who is the emperor during the time of Nehemiah. But what is interesting, we know based on what we're reading here, this is 3 years into reign, so it's 483 BC. We know that's the date. We know that. Artaxerxes was born 483 BC. And Artaxerxes clearly didn't come from Esther because Esther isn't even queen yet. So Artaxerxes was born 483 BC. We have a queen married to Ahasuerus here in 483 BC. It is possible. It is conjecture, but it's certainly possible that this is the same woman and she's pregnant. And maybe that has to do something with it. She doesn't want to stand undignified in this way to begin with because she's also pregnant. Well, we don't know all the reasons, but we do know this is the emperor of the Persian Empire and this is his wife, and there's going to be some sort of response to the fact that she's not willing to do what he says. And, you know, I think of, you know, the day of John the Baptist, you know, with Herod and the queen and his gal, but just, you know, in at times like this, saying foolish things and then you're stuck with what you do and the confusion that comes from it, and that's sort of the way this develops for me as I look through it. But to not listen to the king, you read in verse 12, therefore the king was furious And his anger burned within him. I mean, he's embarrassed, too. He's embarrassed. There's an interesting sculpture that you can see. It's a relief in the city of Persepolis in Iran, the ancient city, Persian city. A lot of ruins they've uncovered. And it was a place that Darius was there quite a bit, but also Xerxes of Ahasuerus. But in the treasury building, as they've uncovered it, there's this interesting relief. It's a sculpture. Just to give you the sense of the way this king saw himself to be honored by the people. But the sculpture is of Darius, his dad, sitting upon the throne. And behind Darius is Ahasuerus standing behind him, both dressed in their, you know, him in his princely attire. Darius seated upon his throne as the king. But the people that are approaching the king in the relief, in the sculpture, as they approach the king, they have their hands over their mouths. And the sculpture, you can go see it today. And as a gesture of tremendous respect, that as I approach you, I even cover my mouth. Well, she refuses to do what he says. He's the emperor, man. He's got all the power and the wealth. He's drunk. He's embarrassed. He gets really ticked. He gets really ticked. So he says to his wise men, these princes that are around him, he says, what should we do? And they declare to him, what she has done needs to be dealt with real firmly. And that's because she's brought shame upon you, but not only upon you, king. She's also brought shame upon all of us. You know, in our culture, the women are to obey their husbands, and she's the top lady, and she's disrespected you. If she does this and gets away with it, other ladies are going to do that. Other wives are going to be disrespecting their husbands. We got to do something about this. So here's what you need to do. So they come up with this plan, and that is the plan that he should divorce her, that she should no longer be the queen, and that she should be replaced, and that this decree, you know, make this law that you know, this shouldn't be repeated, and make it clearly stated, and send it out so everybody knows, and so that all the wives everywhere understand that this was dealt with real firmly. Well, you know, there are a lot of different things we can learn from that. It's true that when I sin, my sin certainly affects other people, no doubt. And if you're in a high position and you do wrong, I mean, it needs to be dealt with in such a way that others understand and not to repeat that. Although I think at the same time, obviously the basis of what's going on is just drunken men and foolish decisions. But this man works to save face. And these letters are sent out. We know the Persians had one of the great postal services of the time. You know, they really had developed that. And so they send out word in different languages so that everybody understands. And so the queen is no longer going to be the queen. Chapter 2, verse 1. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. And let the king appoint officers through all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan the citadel, into the woman's quarter, under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This thing pleased the king, and he did so. Now you read this, you know, the fairy tale, Cinderella sort of story. You read it, and you're thinking, wow, what a great deal to be one of these ladies, right? Josephus says he gathered into his harem an addition 400 concubines. But we understand in the culture, as you study, to be one of these concubines wasn't necessarily the best life to have. You know, if you're into luxury and you're into living in the palace, you'd have a good time. But if you were looking for a relationship with a husband, this was a pretty lousy deal. Because hundreds of women are going to be brought into his harem, but really only one is going to be picked to be the replacement of Vashti. And so you could be brought into his harem, have one night with your husband or the king, and never see him again, but you would then remain essentially like almost like a widow living in the palace for the rest of your life. So we can have that sort of Cinderella read to the story, but for some of these women, many of these women, this not necessarily was something that they would espouse to want to be as a concubine of the king. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us what happens to Vashti, but as I note with you, and I noted earlier, it's very possible that the secular a mistress, the woman named a mistress in the secular world was very likely or very possibly Vashti. And so later, after the death of this king, because she's the mother of Artaxerxes, is that then in the next reign with Artaxerxes, we're told in secular accounts that that woman, Amastris, had a lot of influence during that reign, the following reign, the reign of this man's son. And so she disappears off the scene here, but she might reappear later in history with a woman of tremendous influence when her son reigns as king. Well, this man is seeking refuge and solace in his harem, and that's what we read in secular accounts, that after he loses, as you go a little bit later to verse 16, 17, it's now the seventh year of his reign by the time that Esther goes to be with the king. That's 4 years later. That's after his invasion into Greece and his defeat. And when we're told by the Greek historian that he then went to seek refuge in his harem. And that's exactly what you read here now in Esther chapter 2. Verse 5. In Shushan the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it was when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor, so readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance. Then seven choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. And every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. Each young woman's turn came to go in to King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months' preparation according to the regulations for the women. For thus were the days of their preparations apportioned: 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. Now, some of you gals, you're thinking, that's not a bad deal. You know, it's just six months hanging out in the salon, huh? And then another 6 months. Well, they were oily ladies, though, after all that. Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters to the king's palace. In the evening, she went, and in the morning, she returned to the second house of the women to the custody of Shehagaz, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines. She would not go in to the king again unless the king delighted in her and called her by name. Now when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as daughter to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to the king Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. So you go from this great, powerful king to an orphan girl is the way her life starts. We don't know exactly why, but she's a Jewish girl, but her mom and dad have died. We learned the name of one of her parents there towards Abihail, her father Abihail. But we're not told why, but they die. So this young gal, when life starts out, it isn't very easy. Her parents die. And she has an uncle named Mordecai who then takes her, adopts her, so she's adopted, and she is raised by her uncle. So you got a powerful king. You know, this is like a storybook, but it's true history. A Jewish orphan girl who's adopted, and what God does in that mix. Now, she's also technically, we could say, a slave girl in the sense that the that the Jews were taken initially as slaves into the Babylonian Empire, and then the Persians conquered the Babylonians. So she's from, you know, that class of people. But yet what God does to protect the Jews, what God does to protect his people, to be faithful to his promises, Abraham, and the way he works is so marvelous. Well, we learn Mordecai, her uncle. The name Mordecai is a name that seems to be derived from the name Marduk, which is the Babylonian god. And we read here, too, Esther is known as Hadassah. That's also, you know, a Persian name. Now, in secular accounts, Mordecai, if it's derived as we believe it would be Marduka, there is, in secular accounts, an official who was underneath at one point in time, underneath Ahasuerus, who had that name. And by the time of the end of this book, this man Mordecai has tremendous influence as a Persian official now, right, working for the king. So, son of, we read, you know, he's back to the time where Nebuchadnezzar conquered Jerusalem and took that initial wave, about 10,000 captives, brought them to Babylon, that his relatives were among them, and he was spared. His relatives were spared. And now, you know, about 100-ish years later or so, a little over 100 years later, one of the descendants now is this man Mordecai, who has this adopted niece that he's raising. We're told she's an orphan girl, but we're also told of her beauty. That this young woman was lovely and beautiful. And when the Bible states that, it's declaring that this woman was incredibly beautiful. That's just what it means exactly. She was incredibly beautiful. Now, as you read the context, not only is she obviously beautiful as far as physically to look at, but she's also a woman that seems to have a beautiful way to her. That everybody she's with, as you read through those verses, they appreciate her, and they like her, and they admire her. She has supreme beauty, but also that important beauty, the beauty of the heart. Now, as they're looking around to increase the harem, the Persian officials, they see this beautiful woman. This Jewish woman, they don't know she's Jewish, though, at the time. And she's using the name Hadassah, and they bring her into the king's harem and underneath the king's official. And then what we read is repeatedly is the word favor. In fact, in this story, the English word favor, you know, derived from the Greek word, is used six times. Four times directly stating she received favor, she received favor, she received favor, she received favor. And then, three other times where she sought favor and then was given favor. But that's the story of this young Jewish orphan girl. She continues to receive favor. And the Hebrew word for favor is a word used regularly in the Bible to describe the character of God. It's translated loyal love. And it's just speaking of God's grace and favor, because God has a plan. And God's going to use her. Starts with favor with a harem overseer. And then later in verse 15, she received favor from all the people who just admire her, and eventually she receives favor from the king himself. God just working to prepare her way to be in this place. I think of my little life, and maybe you have the same sort of, I'm sure you do as a child of God, just what God has done. You know, I think of working when I was working at General Electric, and I thought I was just conniving to get a job there. Not conniving, but working everything I could to get a job there, and ended a job in GE. And then working in this special program with 70 engineers where they used to have a field assignment, and they'd send us around to different parts of the company and give us training. And then they used to, in this engineering development program, send you to the field to work with a customer for a little while, and they had stopped it. And they decided to get it going again. There were 70 of us. And it just got going again. And the group just before me worked out to go to Phoenix. And not everybody got to go. I thought, boy, that'd be cool to go for 3 months, pay trip somewhere. So I had heard somewhere that somewhere in the past when they used to do it, somebody had gone to San Diego. And I said, well, let me call San Diego and I'll see if I can just work out that I can go on a field assignment for 3 months to San Diego. That'd be great. Company pay trip. I thought I was just working out what I wanted to work out. I end up living in Lynn, Massachusetts. I go out for 3 months. I'm living in San Diego. Got a company car, company house. You know, I'm like, this is a cool job, man. All paid for. Here I am, San Diego. Well, before I go, I was working with, I'd gone to Boston University, and I, part of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, and now I'm out, and I'm working as an engineer, but I'm still involved helping. Somebody says here, hey, you're going to San Diego. You ought to check out a church called Horizon Christian Fellowship. I used to live in San Diego. I said, all right, I'll check out the church when I go out there. God has this beautiful woman, very lovely, beautiful, supremely wonderful woman out there named Paula. And so I'm out there on a business trip, and I meet this gal named Paula. And I thought, wow, she's beautiful. So I go back to my field assignment ends. I go back to Lynn, now living in Lynn again, working with GE, finishing up this program. She's out in San Diego, and we're going back and forth for 9 months visiting each other. And I get an idea. You know, I'd like to live in San Diego permanently. So somebody tells me about Caterpillar. So I'm gonna go out and visit my wife or this gal that I'd like to marry and see if I can get a job with Caterpillar. I end up going out, one interview, I get this great offer. And just God's favor to prepare me to be in Fitchburg. I get this great offer. And I get this great offer, so I'm like, wow, that's a lot of money. So now I feel guilty. I've been trained for 2 years. GE's invested a fair amount of money to train me. And they even sent me on this business trip and everything. And I'm going to quit my job. Well, right at that time, I come back. I'm nervous about going to quit my job. GE announces a layoff. Well, I'm protected from the layoff. I can't be laid off because I'm in this program. I'm not done with it yet. But I got this idea, well, if I quit and I can save a job, maybe I won't feel so bad, you know? So I wrote a letter to the vice president of engineering. And he says, yeah. He says, George, we'll let you take a voluntary layoff and you can save somebody else's job. So I don't even feel bad about quitting. When I quit because I take a voluntary layoff, I end up getting all this money. So it's like greasing the skids to get me to San Diego. I get out to San Diego. I get all this money. I'm quitting my job. Here's my beautiful woman. And we get married. I'm going to this church called Horizon Christian Fellowship. And it was all God just giving favor. To put me in a place that I start listening to the teaching and God begins to call my life. Well, then I got this stirring about, you know, ministering and then this thoughts about New England and coming back. It was spiritually a tough place for me to be earlier. And then radio and then God just to prepare to get me to Fitchburg even quicker than I wanted to get here. I was going to do more training, church training. A radio station is donated in Fitchburg just to grease the skids, man. Slide me right into here. Outside of the Boston area to plant a church and get a radio. Favor. I just felt, wow, look at that. People around me, my roommates when I worked at GE, they're like, dude, man, you are one lucky guy. Everything seems to work out. Well, I found out later why, you know, it's boom, boom, boom to get me to a place where God had a call in my life and wanted to use my wife and I to come and serve the people of Fitchburg. I just note that because that's what God is doing here, obviously, but in a much, much more significant, obviously, beautiful, powerful, wonderful way. He's putting a Jewish girl in place of tremendous influence to prepare to save the people of Israel and to glorify his name before the world. Well, in verse 19, as we have come to the end of our time, when virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed. And both were hanged on gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So Mordecai, this man, he's a stepdad. He loves his daughter. And boy, he's looking out for her as you read, and he's always checking in. It appears very possible when it says, verse 19, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Most would say that that means he had an official position now. It's very possible when Esther got into her place in the harem that she worked it out, that he had some sort of official government job, because it's usually what that means in the Old Testament. When you're sitting at the king's gate, you're doing some sort of official government business. It's there, that he overhears about a couple of guys that are working within the government that want to take out the king. And there's an assassination attempt. And so Mordecai, hearing that, is also, you know, he's an uncle, a Jewish uncle, but he's gotten out, it appears, an official appointment. He has this discovery, and he seeks to intervene. And that intervention is also very key, sovereignly by God, because his name is recorded. And later the king is, in chapter 6, not going to be able to sleep. And he's going to be reminded of what this man does. And it's all going to lead in a providential way to deliver the nation of Israel. So, assassination attempts, just to note as we stand now, is you can stand as we conclude. The assassination. This King Ahasuerus, it's only about a dozen years later, where he actually is assassinated by the captain of his guard. And so this assassination thing is a serious thing here, and it's not too long later that this very man is assassinated, and his son Artaxerxes takes over as a young man and rules the Persian Empire. So, you know, we just get started this week. We've laid the background. We're just getting started in the book of Esther, and it's just amazing. It's amazing to see what God is doing, laying the background and the framework historically to protect and deliver his people. We're reminded this morning about alcohol. Be careful with that stuff. Be careful because it can make you pretty foolish. It can make a real mess in your life. And we're reminded of foolish oaths and wrath, but yet the grace of God too.